I've asked Shelley to talk about his direct experience. With Bush at Ulaanbaatar Air Base and what he saw and what he confronted Bush with. It's a first-hand experience.
Okay, there's two things. We're talking about two different Bushes, the father and the son, which is the same thing. In January 14, 1986, I met George Bush, the father. I met him in Guatemala when he was coming in to, quote-unquote, bring in the first democracy into that country for many, many years. So I'm at the ambassador's residence, and he comes up to me and shakes my hand and smiles and says, "What is your job description here?" He says, "Well, I'm a DEA agent, and I conduct international narcotics investigations. But I'm also the agent that's in charge of El Salvador. And Mr. Vice President, there's something funny going on with the Contras at El Pango." He smiles, shakes my hand, doesn't say a word, and walks away. I knew then and there that he knew that his baby, that apparatus outside the CIA that was working drugs at El Pango, that he knew about it. Now, let's go back to George W. Bush. This is a fact, but nobody wants to touch it. There's an individual by the name of Luis de la Garza. He's a big PRI guy in Dallas, Texas, PRI from the party in Mexico. Luis de la Garza has multi-million dollar investors from Guanajuato, Mexico. Who's from Guanajuato? Fox, Vicente Fox. Well, guess what? Mr. De La Garza owns Canal 45 TV station in Dallas, Texas. He used to be an announcer for the Texas Rangers. Okay, here comes the puzzle. So, in 1995, Mr. De La Garza's business was raided by the FBI and the DEA. They had a search warrant. To have a search warrant, you've got to have probable cause, you've got to have an affidavit, a sworn testimony saying that there were drugs there and a reliable informant was involved. They found a stolen car and some other stuff, maybe. Anyway, to make a long story short, Mr. De La Garza turns around in 1999 and holds a fundraiser for George W. Bush for $100,000. A few months ago, he held a fundraiser for George W. Bush for $1 million. George Bush promised him that he would be the brand new director of Hispanic Affairs at the White House. This is a guy who's a Mexican citizen who gets all the money from Mexico to support George W. Bush. Anywhere George W. Bush goes, there he is. And he just put Vicente Fox, who's a personal friend of Luis de la Garza, and George Bush together. Now, if you think the floodgates are open now, ain't going to be no more gates. And guys, this is going to get worse before it gets better. And I'm going to tell you why. One out of four in the immediate family is now involved in using drugs or selling drugs. It is destroying the Latino community, the black community, all the minorities. Okay? One out of four. If I turn around, if I point to somebody, they're going to tell me right now that someone very close to them was involved, is arrested, is in jail or somewhere. 5 years ago, it was an uncle or a cousin that was involved. Now it's home. And when the father or the son or the daughter goes to jail, it doesn't only destroy that person, it destroys the family. That's why it's very important. You know, I don't care if I got 50 people here in the audience. If I educate you in what I just told you, you will turn around, get on the phone, or tell somebody else about it. But the CIA, this U.S. government is so corrupt, we got to put a stop to it. Whatever means, because we tried it peacefully, and they laugh at us. And nobody cares. And the ordinary American person is in denial. They don't want to hear about it. My daughter tells me, Dad, what do you care what's going on in Colombia? And, you know, we live in our own little world. You know, nobody's going to bother us until what? It heads home. And I tell you what, I'm an expert witness on informants, agents, procedures now. I testified before different trials all over the country for the defense. Out of maybe the 10 cases that worked, every single case I found government misconduct by the agents, perjury. What else? Informants, perjury. This agent is supposed to be going to jail, but guess what? They turn around and they cut a deal with the defendant. And that's it. It stops there. So we talked about police brutality a while ago. There's another kind of police brutality that people don't talk about. And it's what I just told you about. It's getting worse, guys. They're violating our civil liberties. They're taking it away from us. So if you know people, educate them. Guys, these are facts I'm telling you. They're not allegations. This is what really is happening. And look around you. What do we got? 50 people maybe in here. Where's everybody else? Where's the Latino community? Everybody's got an agenda. That's fine. But they need to be educated, guys. You go home and you make your phone calls today and you tell them what's going on. Bill, I'll be speaking when? Do you know? I'll be speaking when? Do you know? At the Shadow Convention?
Oh,
at the.
You'll be probably around 1 o'clock.
1 o'clock. Wednesday. Tuesday. Tuesday, 1 o'clock.
Shadow Convention, Shadow. Got a call.
Right.
And hopefully I'll show a slideshow presentation. Slideshow presentation's got the good, the bad, and the ugly. CIA agents' pictures. I will have people that were tortured with case files, times and dates, guys. For the first time ever, I'm taking a chance of going to jail. But you know what? Somebody's got to do it. Thank you.
I'm going to ask Shelly to relate one more experience he had of what he saw at the Longabo Air Base.
Okay. At Ilopango, I had a source of information, a guy. This guy was a guy that worked at Ilopango Airport. This guy did all the flight plans for the contra pilots. And a flight plan, for you people who don't know, is a pilot that's going from Ilopango to Colombia, to the Bahamas, or anywhere. And he will make the flight plans, passports, how much fuel, passengers, and so forth. Drugs were leaving. Ilopango was the O'Hare Airport. Massive kilos of cocaine was leaving Ilopango to the U.S. Military bases, guys. Military bases in the U.S. that were flying this large quantity. That's why we had so many kilos of cocaine in the streets in the 80s. That's why we have more drugs than we ever had in the history. Why? And it wasn't to support the Contras, guys. Don't ever think that. It all went into Swiss bank accounts, where a lot of it was found. The guy who worked at Ilopango was who? Oliver North, Felix Rodriguez, Cubano. Oliver North, in 1994, ran for U.S. Senate. He wanted to be the vice president. In 1991, there's a DEA file on Oliver North for smuggling weapons into the Philippines. How can it be that this guy is running for a U.S. senator's position and be documented in DEA files as a trafficker? You know, this is where we've gotten to right now. Look at George W. Bush. I swear to God, the story I just told you about Mr. De La Garza, it's a fact. Narco News out of Mexico has the story. But guess what? Might be a little scared. Because Guanajuato is where Fox is from. I don't know. Drugs were leaving Ilopango. I saw the cases. I documented. Not only drugs. I'm talking about $5 million cash every week going to the Bahamas, going to Panama by these contra pilots. I got surveillance pictures. I got a lot of documentation. And to just end the whole thing, because it's very important for you to know, it's not only drug trafficking, but murders. I got a passport. I got two passports of two Mexicanas, and their father were murdered in Guatemala after they seized 3,000 kilos of cocaine. They were tortured. They were raped. And then they were, arms and legs were cut off. They were put in 55-gallon drums. They drilled holes into them, and they took them out to sea, never to be found again. With the knowledge of the CIA, I can prove that because I have the passports, the original passports. So it's not only drug trafficking, money laundering, but murder. And I can prove that. Thank you.
Going to give a couple of minutes, about 3 to 5 minutes, to Sister Donna Warren, who is one of the lead plaintiffs in the case against the CIA on the matter of drugs.
Good evening. Thank you, Deli. I appreciate these few minutes to just let you know what it is that can be done. Our esteemed panelists have told you about the harms that have been done because of the CIA. Well, they really haven't told you about the harms that have been done in the South Central, and there's been very many of them. I went a little bit earlier today to an event that was an official DNC event. It was the Tavis Smalley gathering of celebrities and politicians. I went in there with my list, which I didn't bring that list tonight, but I did bring some more information for you. I went in there with a list that said, what are the real issues in South Central? Because that conference was sponsored by Microsoft, AT&T, the Census Bureau, and whatnot. And I figured they're not going to be talking about the real issues. I kind of wormed my way inside because there were thousands of people there. 99.9% African American. When I got in, surprisingly, a couple of people that I heard were talking about the issues. Nikki Giovanni believes that prisoners should be given the right to vote, and I do too. Lainey Grenier, who was Clinton's first choice for a attorney general position, was talking about the differences in the treatment of black and white and brown children, as Dedan described to us a little bit earlier. And so I said, okay, why are all these people here? Well, I knew why they were here. Bread and circuses. That's what this country is all about. Then I come here, to tell you the truth, I expected to see this whole auditorium filled. Because the real issues are being talked about at the People's Convention. My question, of course, I'm not going to let anybody get away with anything. You know, my question is, where is D2K, which I am supporting every single one of those issues? You know, I don't know. I wish that the room was filled. I hope that the 10 to 50,000 protesters who are coming to Los Angeles, and Los Angeles is more than ready to maim, kill, and deprive people of their First Amendment rights. I hope that as a result of this convention, the two actually meet, and a little bit later, when the Democrats have left, we can give a people's convention that will represent our will, include our brain, all the people of the United States, all the people of California, all the people whose issues this convention is addressing. And the reason I say that, I've got something for you tonight. Yes, I am the lead plaintiff of the class action lawsuit against the CIA and the Department of Justice. We filed the lawsuit March the 15th, 1999. My attorney is here. I am so happy to see him because he is very hard to catch up with, but I got him now. I got him now. And some other attorneys filed the report. Why did they file it? They filed it because the United States government knowingly and willingly allowed crack cocaine to come into my South Central community. And as a result of that, I don't have my beautiful son anymore. And I am as mad as hell. And Joey Patrick Warren's name, I am not going to back up off of this case. What can this case do? This case, now everyone talked about what the CIA has done. The CIA has been doing this for 50 years. The question is, what can we do to stop the CIA from doing this again? This class action lawsuit is a perfect mechanism to bring the CIA to its knees. We don't have any other mechanism to hold their feet to the fire, but we've got this one. I brought copies of the Standard Form 95, which is the tort claim against the CIA, to file for damages. And some of you might say, well, you know, I don't know, have anybody in my family. Yes, you do. Crack cocaine has destroyed, and I will wrap it up. Crack cocaine has destroyed my family, my society, my community, my country. Every single one of you are part of my community and my country. And together with this class action lawsuit, and the tort claims have to be filed by October the 8th of this year, I put my name and address on there. I'm not only the lead plaintiff, I am the lead organizer of this class action lawsuit. I want you to take a copy, take it to your friends, have them fill it out yourself, and I am going to give you a copy of this letter that we sent out to the municipalities. Why did we do that? Because the cities have been harmed by this crack cocaine and hospital costs and, believe it or not, police costs in the problems that have affected the community. Take one of those and write and call your city councilman, call your congressperson, especially call Julian Dixon, who is probably the biggest sellout that there is, and tell them that we will not stand for the government. And I'm hoping that bill will tell us what the government is trying to do. We will not stand for the government's sabotage of this class action lawsuit. Now, Deli is about to get me off, so I think I'll say good night, and it's really, really good seeing you here.
You've been listening to a panel on crack and the CIA, presented at the People's Convention in Los Angeles last week as part of the week of protests targeting the Democratic Party's National Convention. We'll be back with a panel on the prison industrial complex of which Seneca County is now a part.
Hey, honey, I'm home.
Wow, what's that?
It's the new Bush campaign souvenir, the Death Watch. The alarm goes off every time they execute someone in Texas.
Wow, it's ringing again.
I know. It seems to go off every few seconds.
The Death Watch. It's alarming.
And now, a preview of this year's presidential debates.
Vice President Gore, how you feel about keeping the minimum wage below the cost of living?
I think it tastes great.
Governor Bush?
I think it's less filling.
Vice President Gore, what do you think about ignoring human rights in China and approving permanent normal trade relations with no conditions?
Tastes great.
Governor Bush?
Less filling.
And how do you feel about tens of billions of dollars in taxpayer giveaways to huge corporations?
Well, so far, it's tasted great. I feel that it's less filling.
Brought to you by BNS for Bush or Gore, because it doesn't really matter who you vote for. We've already bought them.
Forget about stocks. Forget about bonds. There's a lucrative new investment arena. Legislation. A good mutual fund might return 20% a year, but in the low-risk, high-return world of legislation, your investment dollar can return over 100,000%.
Us folks at the tobacco industry spent $30 million in campaign contributions for a tax break worth $50 billion. The return on our investment, 167,000%.
Here's how it works. With the help of a professional legislation broker called a lobbyist, you place your investment, called a campaign contribution, with a carefully selected list of legislation manufacturers called members of Congress. They go to work, crafting industry-specific subsidies, inserting tax breaks into the tax code, or giving away public property for free. The effect on your bottom line is immediate and huge.
For a paltry $5 million in campaign contributions, we here at the broadcasting industry were able to secure free digital TV licenses worth $70 billion. That's an incredible 1,400,000% return on our investment.
If you can get this kind of return when you buy a bunch of congressmen, just imagine what you can get when you buy the president. Don't wait. Invest now and let the paybacks roll in for the next 4 years.
Paid for by Billionaires for Bush or Gore. Because it doesn't really matter who you vote for, we've already bought them. www.billionairesforbushorgore.com.
Ah, W here. Kids, before 1974... I was one, too. Now, I'm reforming education. How? Well, by putting reform and schools together in what I call reform schools. And forget detention. We've got detention centers. Lots of them, folks. So come on down to Texas. We've got your future locked up.
This next session is going to be about the prison industrial complex and police abuse. I'd like to just, first of all, apologize for one of our speakers who couldn't make it today. Richard Trujillo from the California Justice Center was unable to make it here today because they are so busy organizing for the demonstration on the 16th. And in his stead, I'm going to just give some short information about the problem of prison labor. This is why it's so important to have this session here about the prison industrial complex. It's because a lot of us are beginning to feel, in California especially, but in other states as well, that the prison industrial complex is becoming the new slavery, where they're herding in our youths and our people of color with Proposition 21 into prisons where they'll work for companies like Victoria's Secret, TWA, McDonald's, JCPenney, Starbucks, and others at pennies per hour. These are the same jobs that these corporations would not let these young people have for $9 or $10 an hour so they could go to school, learn a trade, support a family. There is some really good information out there on the internet. The Justice Policy Institute has some information. These will be over at the table. Another internet site called The New Capitalism also has some information. This is available to us, the public, so that we can find out why exactly they're building prisons and why exactly young people have no jobs. And I'm about to introduce one of our panelists, Janice Jordan from California Coalition of Women Prisoners. And she's going to give some information about a tape that... that speaks to this issue, and also talk a little about, in general, about this women's problems in prisons.
Good afternoon. Real quick, just to reflect on what she was talking about, prison labor. I have this great 7-minute promo tape up here. It was put up by the Joint Venture Program. And those of you who are not familiar with it, the Joint Venture Program is a national organization that sends this 7-minute tape into prisons and to businesses. Specifically to the businesses, it states why they should break down their industry on the outs and put it on the in. And what we have just witnessed recently is actually a John Deere plant laid off, I think, something like 200 workers and it went inside a prison. Now, when you see this tape, if you don't watch it from the beginning, I've actually had friends walk in on it and thought it was a satire. And I guarantee you will laugh and throw up at the same time. Really? No, seriously. I want to talk a little bit about women prisoners. Regardless of what you think, women are the fastest growing prison population in the U.S. We are still lower in numbers, but we are growing at 6.5% a year. Men are growing about 4.7% a year. California is home to the two world's largest prisons, and they're both in Chowchilla, Chowchilla State Prison and Valley State. It's disgusting. Not only what's going on in the women's prisons are medical abuse and neglect and physical abuse. A woman will go in for a broken arm, she gets a pap smear. A woman goes in for a headache, she gets a pap smear. Ted Koppel actually exposed this last November. It was a great Nightline segment, and I'm sorry that I don't have any of those tapes with me. But he interviewed the doctor who oversaw the doctors and nurses who were giving these pap smears. The administrator's response was, "This is the only male contact the women prisoners get." Now, he was not fired from his job. He was reassigned up to Sacramento, overseeing the medical efficiency of the administration of these women prisons. This is disgusting, what's going on. You have a headache, you go to see an EMT, which is just another prison guard. They have no experience on what it means to look at your body or to talk to you as a doctor or any type of registered nurse was, as there is no full-time registered nurse or full-time registered doctor. You might get an aspirin 3 days later. This is completely unacceptable. 75% of the women that are incarcerated are there for nonviolent crimes, as of men. Most men that are incarcerated, nonviolent crimes, what we call victimless crimes, selling pot, possession, maybe robbery. I'm not talking strong-arm robbery, robbery. We are not seeing rehabilitation anymore. Education has been stripped, not only in men's facilities, but women's facilities. Unfortunately, who's affected the most when a woman goes to prison is her child. And 80% of the women that are in prison have at least one child. And you know what happens to those kids? They're sent to the state. Maybe a grandparent will raise them if somebody has that luxury. What's even sadder is a woman who goes into prison who's pregnant. If she gives birth while she's in prison, she is shackled to the gurney while she's giving birth. This is horrible. This is extreme physical abuse. Now, for those women who've gone through labor, imagine what it would be like sitting with your legs up in the air, shackled, while you're giving birth to your child. If you don't have a family member, and they have to prove that they're a family member, if you don't have a family member that picks up that child within 48 hours, you know where that child goes? To the state. Luckily, when Ted Koppel was doing this, and I think it's only because he did this interview, there was a woman there who didn't have a valid family member to come pick up her child. Her partner was also in prison, who she was not married to, and her partner's mother came to pick up the child. The state was going to refuse to recognize her as a grandmother because they weren't married. But I think it's because Ted Koppel was there, she was actually able to hand the child over to this woman. Now, she's not handing it directly to this grandmother. She can't even see her family member that she's giving the child to. A sheriff comes in, takes the baby away, gives it to this grandmother as they sign papers, like it's just a piece of property, and off they go. It's the most devastating effect for me as a parent to watch another woman go through that. I have 1 minute, 6 minutes goes by fast. I would encourage you to get involved in whichever way you can. Women, right now, I know overall we've built 22 new prisons in the state of California, one state university. That's completely unacceptable. What they are saying to us is that our children have a better chance of going to prison than they do in education. And my daughter, who is of mixed race, is one of those statistics. And I am scared for her. I actually thought when Proposition 21 passed, she's going to become a target. She's already pissed off at the cops. And what's going to happen when she becomes a 15-year-old black woman, real mouthy on the corner, and just speaking out for her rights, they're going to throw her in. And that's already happening. A week after Proposition 21 was passed, young girls were already being sent to women's state facility. Get involved in whichever way you can. I've got lots of literature up here, specifically the case on Teresa Cruz, who we're doing a vigil and a parole board hearing call-in day. Come see me. I'll be up here all night long. Thank you.
Thank you, Janice. We've all heard lately about the problem of drugs in communities and communities on drugs. Here to speak about the specifics of the economics that are driving undermining communities with drugs is a well-known speaker, Michael Rupert. He's from the Wilderness Publications, a former policeman, and he knows pretty much everything, so I'll let him speak.
Well, it's nice to be told that I know pretty much everything. I'll have to ask myself some questions later on. Let me throw a few facts out to you that will maybe put some things in perspective, because when we talk about the prison industrial complex and we talk about the economics of the whole thing, we're talking about an economic ecosystem. Many of you know that this year the United States became a nation which imprisons 2 million of its citizens. 1 million of those have been added in the last decade, and of those, 60 to 70% are nonviolent drug offenders. And again, you're absolutely right about the increasing number of women in prison who are also serving, in effect, the slave labor role, taking airline reservations, doing data processing for the Department of Justice, working for maybe a buck, maybe $2 an hour. But let me throw out some other numbers for you. Now you can hear probably as well as the FBI can. Le Monde, one of the best publications in the world for investigative journalism, has come up with this figure. The UN said it was $440 billion in 1996. The Department of Justice estimates it at between $400 and $500 billion a year. But I like the figure of $500 billion a year. $500 billion a year passes in the drug trade. That money gets laundered. It moves through the economy. And I have documented in my publication From the Wilderness how much of that money ends up in Wall Street, buoying the Dow Jones Industrial Average. You may not know that last July, a year ago, the president of the New York Stock Exchange, Richard Grasso, went to Colombia and visited the FARC guerrillas and asked them to invest their drug profits in Wall Street. And we are rushing headlong toward a war in Colombia even as we speak. No, they did not. Now, there's quite a bit to the way this all feeds in, but what's important to understand is that when President Richard Nixon started the war on drugs in 1972, the federal budget allocation at the federal level for law enforcement was $101 million. As we entered fiscal year 2000, the federal law enforcement budget allocation for the war on drugs was $17 billion. And yet, there are more drugs in this country today, and they are cheaper, and they are more potent than they were in 1972. What's wrong with the picture? Well, first of all, while it's illegal to move $10,000 in cash and the banking industry has to report cash transactions for money laundering, there is no requirement at all on the securities industry. And we document heavily, and please visit us at our table back in the back From the Wilderness. We've got lots of information on this, how it's used to support Wall Street. But now let's turn to the other side of the coin, and let's use a model from right here in Los Angeles. I've only got about, 3 minutes left, I think. So here in Los Angeles, we're all familiar with the Gary Webb stories from 1996 about Freeway Ricky Ross, who was the so-called godfather of crack cocaine, and how the CIA was directly tied to what became an absolute epidemic of crack cocaine use in South Central Los Angeles. By the way, for those of you who don't know, the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has just ruled in favor of Contra leader Renato Pena, based on information generated from that, that there is direct validity to his claims that the agency was running drugs, and he's now entitled to an evidentiary hearing. The U.S. Ninth Circuit read the same reports we've all read that the major media missed and said it's true. But now I want to use a model for you. I've had write for me in my publication, From the Wilderness, a former Assistant Secretary of Housing, Catherine Austin Fitz, who documented and we published a very dramatic map in the May 1999 issue of single-family home loan defaults in South Central Los Angeles. And if you look at this map, we have it at my table, you see that South Central is just a blot of single-family home loans that defaulted, meaning that as young African Americans were going to jail for prison, the rich people who were bringing in the cocaine for the CIA said, let's use their money to steal their homes and put them in jail so they can pay us to steal their property. Because what happened was, as the hardworking middle-class families in South Central Los Angeles found their $100,000 homes worth $30,000 in the middle of a crack epidemic, they defaulted. And just a few years later, somebody else conveniently making large political campaign contributions bought those same houses for pennies on the dollar. And that's how the wealth gets stolen and recycled. If I were to make it simple, I would say, kill the Indians and take the land. Kill the Indians and take the land. But even more so, put them in prison. And that's what's important about this complex. And it is a complex of prison industrial labor, which now generates prisoners, because the other half of that, the other portion of that $17 billion equation on the drug war is the $13 billion that's spent on prisons to house inmates who work for pennies on the dollar, taking reservations for TWA or processing credit card orders for Citibank. And that $13 billion, somebody said, you know, somebody has a headache, you get a pap smear, and they bill them, and psychiatrists make $45,000 or $50,000, $60,000, and the largest lobby in this state is prison guards. right now. Now, this is an essential thing to understand because all of this is fueled by one thing, which is the prohibition of illegal drugs and the value that is placed on those drugs, just exactly the way it was done with prohibition in the 20s. And the way to pull the plug on the whole system is to decriminalize drugs, everything. As we get ready to go to war in Colombia, we're going to see maybe 10,000 people maybe come to this convention the next time when their children are getting ready to go fight in Colombia. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. When entire communities are targeted as exploitable, cheap prison labor, or targeted as expendable altogether, police brutality and harassment in those communities will increase. Here to talk about police brutality and organized community fight back is Joey Johnson of the October 22nd Coalition.
Thank you very much. I'm going to get right to the point because I think this is very important what people are doing here today. But what I want to focus up on is not so much like the problem of what's happening, because I think every day people, the news is filled with it, but more like what are we going to do about it? Because in 1996, I was part of a group of a number of people from coast to coast who decided that really there was an epidemic of police brutality going on and that something needed to be done about it and that we needed to do it on a nationwide basis because police brutality, for too long, people had been fighting it kind of like case by case or city by city or incident by incident. We decided we needed to nationwide bring together a movement of all those forces that were organizing against police brutality. So we initiated the October 22nd Coalition to Stop Police Brutality, Repression, and the Criminalization of a Generation. And the significance of October 22nd was that was the date upon which the first National Day of Protest was in 1996. And we've kept that date and we've kept that name. And in the years that have transpired, the National Day of Protest has grown. From here in L.A., the first year was about 250 people. To the second year, it was about 750 people. In the third year, in 1998, it was 1,500 people. And this past October 22nd, it was over 3,000 people marching to Parker Center, the headquarters of the LAPD, and condemning them for their brutality and murders of so many people, countless numbers of people throughout Los Angeles and along with other police agencies throughout Southern California. So this coalition, the October 22nd Coalition, we feel like it brings two unique contributions to the movement to stop police brutality. And that's really what we all need to be about, not trying to lessen it a little bit or lighten it up a little bit, but really how are we going to stop it? How are we going to put an end to it? And we feel that nationwide there needs to be a movement, and we've been making progress in bringing that into being and strengthening it from coast to coast and providing a platform for the family members, especially family members of people that have been murdered by the police, for their stories to be told and to be heard. And we feel that this movement needs to become even more organized, even stronger, because as you all know, they're still out there murdering people. They haven't backed up off of it. And so that means what we've done has been important and significant, but it's not enough, and we need to take it higher, we need to take it further. There's two unique contributions that I feel that the October 22nd Coalition brings to this movement against police brutality nationwide. One is the National Day of Protest on October 22nd, and the other is the Stolen Lives Project. This is a book that I want you all to know about, and some I'm sure already do. It's called Stolen Lives, and it's a listing of over 2,000 names of people that have been murdered by the police in this country since 1990. This was a project that the October 22nd Coalition undertook in conjunction with the National Lawyers Guild and the Anthony Baez Foundation. For those that don't know, Anthony Baez was a young Puerto Rican man in New York City who was murdered by a NYPD police chokehold because his football landed on a cop's car. So what our coalition set out to do was to document so that people that would say, oh, this is just an isolated incident, it's not as widespread as you're saying, we say, no, here it is, right here. And so we began compiling the cases from going out to rallies, from talking to police brutality attorneys, from taking clippings from newspapers, from whatever source that we could, and began to compile this list. And you should know that in 1994, the Justice Department was instructed to undertake this project by Congress. and yet they never actually did it. I wonder why. You know, I think because this is damaging information. It puts a human face. It puts a human face on something that the powers that be want to deny is taking place. So the Stolen Lives Project, and along with it, what we try to do is provide a platform for the families, as I said, of people that have been murdered, to speak, you know, to have their stories heard and projected out to society as a whole. And we do that every year on October 22nd on the National Day of Protest, and we do it throughout the year by networking with other family members and other struggles against police brutality that are going on in different places, like in Riverside, and the murder of Taisha Miller, which is something our coalition has been very involved in, or here, the whole Rampart scandal and what it has revealed about what we've been saying all along, and that many people tried to dismiss, that the police routinely plant weapons on people, frame people, shoot unarmed people in the head, and then write their police report and their cover up while the person lays there and bleeds to death, like what happened with a young brother named Juan Saldana, living in the Pico Union area, who was murdered by Rampart cops. One thing our coalition did was to put out a statement against the Rampart murders and mayhem by the LAPD, and we distributed over 50,000 of these in English and 20,000 in Spanish through our neighborhoods and barrios, you know, in Los Angeles. Just one last point I want to make around this prison industrial complex, because I feel like it's a controversial issue and stuff. We all have agreement that there's mass incarceration going on. The thing we have a difference on is like what's motivating it. I don't believe that it's sufficient as analysis to say that the reason that we have the most unprecedented mass prison expansion in the history of this country is because of the corporations trying to make profit off of it within the jail system. Actually, if you look at the statistics, the prison population in this country, I'm going to wrap real quick, has gone from 200,000 in 1980 to 2 million this year. Of that, only about 5% of those people are involved in prison labor. Really, what I think is going on is we have to look at this whole process of capitalist globalization and the fact that the imperialists are sending all these factories all over the world so they don't have a place to profitably exploit millions and millions of young people. And they got national security concerns. They got concerns about social upheaval if those youth are out on the street. So that to me is that's like getting more hitting the nail on the head in terms of why do we face this unprecedented expansion of the prison system, application of the death penalty, on and on. I'm calling everybody, come out for the protest on August 16th at the Democratic Convention Wednesday. The theme of the day is fighting against police brutality, protesting against police brutality, and come out on October 22nd for the National Day of Protest and Literature and all that's here. Thank you.
Thanks, Joey. In any area of social change, and particularly when we're fighting the capitalist-owned police state, it's important that entire communities become educated and organized. And today we're fortunate enough to have with us a woman who has had extensive experience in doing just that, organizing and educating her community. Tilda Sosaya works with Committee on Prison Accountability in New Mexico, and she's here today. Tilda Sosaya.
I'm new to organizing, actually, and this is a very grassroots process that I became engaged in last autumn. We had a major incident in one of our prisons, and I might tell you this as an antecedent. 5 years ago, we had three prisons in New Mexico, and they were all state-owned. Today, we have five private prisons in New Mexico. And our governor, Gary Johnson, will soon be speaking at the Shadow Convention. And he's being touted as the poster boy for drug reform across the country. I don't mean to invalidate his ideas, because he does have some good ideas. But I will say that we must beware, because where there's smoke, there's fire, as we all know. As I said, in New Mexico, we had only three prisons until 5 years ago. In this 5 years, a few other things have happened. The rate of incarceration among men has taken a jump of 36%, but among women, it has jumped 116% in 5 years. Imprisonment has a history, as everything does, and there are reasons for it. And we look back on how people have been punished over the years, and we have to realize one basic thing, and that is being removed from the community, from the home and family, is the punishment. Prison is the punishment. And this is what I try more than anything else to bring across to the public. We are a group basically of families. My son is an inmate in New Mexico, and we came together after a riot had occurred in the fall. It was a tragic time. Men were sent from New Mexico 2,000 miles away to a huge, overwhelmingly horrible fortress, a level 6 super maximum security unit. Families were up in arms. They didn't know their loved ones were being taken until they saw them on television lying on the tarmac with armed guards all around them, SWAT teams, SORT teams, DART teams, and CERT teams. What are all these acronyms? What do they mean? Who employs them, and where do they come from? These are questions everyone began to ask, and they needed answers. And people were very, very upset. We had an ACLU meeting, and we organized from that day onward. And it was mid-September, just a couple weeks after this incident had occurred. From that point on, it was finding ways and means of getting support from the community, which is really difficult because prisoners are our least popular citizens. We went out and talked to legislators. We went out and talked to other community leaders, and we began to make our voices heard by demonstrating, by taking it to the streets, making signs, carrying posters, shouting chants, and generally making a nuisance in front of the state capitol building. We did a major campaign in October. We did another one in December, which was a Christmas vigil. It was 1 week before Christmas. It was candlelight. In New Mexico, we have a custom of using farolitos to greet friends as they come to our house. You take a little paper sack and you fill it with sand and you put a candle in it, and those are farolitos, and you light them. So we lined the whole stage and stairway down at Civic Plaza in the middle of Albuquerque and had about 60 people show up for our demonstration, and that was televised, and it was one of the good moments. Generally, we're ignored. The press does not want to pay attention to us because the powers that be don't want them to. On July 15th, there was a nationwide prison reform unity project that came about as a result of a group of women who had met one another online. One woman said, What if we decided to choose one day when all of us take to the streets? What if we all stood in front of our prisons in our states and said, no more? And that what if grew into a coalition, and that coalition successfully gathered large numbers of people all over the country. I think y'all in California had everyone way beat at Chowchilla. But in New Mexico, which is a relatively small state, we succeeded in bringing out about 150 people. There were 30 or so armed guards. We have 5 prisons in one spot, a medium maximum, and now a new supermax, and a jail across the way. We had probably 8 to 10 armed guards in front of each of those facilities. They would not let us near. Our demonstration took place on the back of a pickup truck with a bullhorn and speakers jumping up and down from the bed of that pickup truck. All in all, it was a pretty exciting moment because we were able to get some press, to get some word out to people. And as a result, we've been invited now more. I go to places and talk to 12 people in a nursing home, and those 12 people will then pick up the phone and help us out. And I think that's the way you organize. It's person to person. It's very individual sometimes, and it's got to come from the heart. If you don't have it here, you're never going to get it out this way. So I thank you for your time, and I'm really happy to have been here with you today. Thank you.
Tilda, thank you very much. There's a special problem of people who fight back against the system, people like Janice, people like Sosiah, people like all of us in our communities.
we can be targeted as agitators. And the special types of imprisonment and harassment that await folks who are targeted as agitators and troublemakers to the system are known by all of us. Many of us have worked on the Leonard Peltier campaign or the Mumia campaign. We have here Jean Day, a national spokesperson for the Leonard Peltier campaign, who would like to say a few words about Lynn.
I want to thank you for all the work that you have done for Leonard already. Because of your voices and what you've done, Leonard's health is now getting a little better. For many years, he walked around with a frozen jaw, and now he's able to move it. Now he's able to start eating protein, of which he really needed really bad. This past June 12th, a group of us went into the prison to go and visit Leonard, not only to visit Leonard, to have a parole review. Before we even walked out of the prison, the answer came back to us, no. This is the second time. 1998 was the first time he had a parole review, and then, of course, this year, 2000. We've been doing many things legally to get things going for Leonard, even bringing on new attorneys to help work on his case. Some of the things I heard talk about today are, I'm going to give you some of the things that Leonard and I would talk about. He went and he said, you know, the prison systems, the largest reservation that's growing now is in the prison system. That means many of our brothers and sisters, indigenous people here in this continent, are now in prisons. There was another comment about kill the Indians, take the land. Well, baby, we're still here, and we're not leaving. And when you look at Leonard's case, the biggest reason Leonard is in prison is because he stood up. He was targeted even before we went into Oglala, even before we started living there. Some of the things we did there in that community was help organize it, to get it going to a point where they weren't afraid to stand up because they knew we were standing behind them. They knew we were standing next to them, and they knew Leonard was going to be there to help protect him too. And we did that. But out of that came his imprisonment. His two other co-defendants are free right now on acquittals of self-defense. And that's some of the things that need to be brought up more into communities of the truth of really what happened to us during that time. During that time, we were just a group of everyday common citizens like you. And probably in some of your own homes, you have to have weapons in your home to protect your home. Well, we did too. But we didn't do it where we were, what they call us, dog soldiers, mercenaries. Mercenaries, I think from the Webster Dictionary, said somebody that you get paid for. We didn't get paid nothing. But we did find out a lot of things out there about ourselves and being Native American people. And that's what I want to say about the Lakota people, is they really helped us and taught us many things. It had not been for the people of Oglala, more people would have died that day. Not just Joe Stuntz, but more people would have died. I'm going to bring another thing in here that we've been really working on right now, is that Leonard only has maybe 5 months. We've had executive clemency on Clinton's desk for 7.5 years. We only have 5 more months before he is no longer president. It is very, very vital that we get Leonard out of prison now. After seeing Leonard and knowing him 25 years ago, his hope is that he will be free before the end of the year or before Clinton leaves office. My fear, and always this has been a fear, that he won't be. If he won't be out by that time, when you look at Leonard's sentence, it was two life sentences served consecutively. That means he wouldn't be out until 2045. Leonard's going to be 56 next month. I don't think he's going to make it. So right now, in order to keep his spirits up, We on the Defense Committee and those people who are out there working for him have to let him know how much work we're doing in order for him to be free. I want every one of you, for our campaign for the last year was to call on regional days, certain regions will call into the White House. I am asking you to do it every day. It doesn't cost that much. And the phone number is 202-456-1111. I know it real well. And to write postcards to the White House demanding executive clemency for Leonard Peltier. Leonard, I do not want to see die in prison. We are asking, too, the president. He went over to India and said, let the Muslims and the Hindus heal of all the things that have gone on in the country of India. Well, they called us Indians because they thought they were India. Well, I'm asking the President of the United States to begin that healing between indigenous people here in the United States and the United States government, and of him being the first president to say, we are really sorry for what we've done to you as a government, and I'm going to free Leonard Peltier. And that is the message I want to send to him. Thank you very much.
And that was a panel discussion on the prison industrial complex, which took place last week in Los Angeles at the People's Convention. It was a part of the events organized around the Festival of Resistance in response to the Democratic National Convention and its failure to cover the issues. Thanks to Billionaires for Bush or Gore and GWBush.com for the public service uncommercials used in today's program.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us through our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. That's radio, the number 4, ALL.org/unwelcome. You can also download shows you may have missed or get more info on the topics covered. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content. Always be filled by Unwelcome.